Welcome to Robert Bellissimo at the Movies. This is a YouTube video podcast exploring storytelling on film, as well as interviews with industry professionals who work in film, television, and theater, and other areas of the arts. It is my honor today to welcome Alan Heim, who is an Academy Award-winning American film editor. With a long and distinguished career in the film business, Alan has more than 30 feature film credits to his name. Some of his credits include some of the greatest films ever made, in my view, Lenny, Network, All That Jazz, Star 80, Alpha Dog, among many more. Alan, welcome. Thanks again for joining me today.
Thank you, Robert. Pleasure to be here.
I wanted to talk about your upbringing a little bit. What did your, I know you were born in the Bronx in New York. What did your parents do?
Oh, my father had a retail business, a furniture business, and my mother was a homemaker, which was pretty much the thing that mothers did in those days.
And what got you interested in film initially? Were your parents film people interested in film, or how did that start?
Not a bit. As soon as I could walk away from my neighborhood, I started going to movies in theaters, and we had at least five movies within walking distance of my house. So I would spend Saturdays there. Even before that, I guess my parents probably took me to kids' movies. We had a theater that was devoted to Westerns and kids' movies, a triple feature. I guess every town had them, and the Bronx was kind of a small town then. So yeah, I think it was called the Star Theater on a block of Southern Boulevard, which also had two Lowe's theaters. One was a first run theater, or maybe a second run. I guess first one was downtown. And the second one showed double features, below Spooner.
Do you remember the first film that you really loved, or the first television show that you really kind of got interested in then working in the field?
Absolutely not. I got, I attended City College in New York at the time, which was free, which was about what my family could afford. And I wasn't particularly highly motivated. And I dropped out after my first semester, really, first year. And a friend I had met at school, when I was gonna go back to school the following summer, I worked for a summer in at a camera store selling filters. And I thought, I don't wanna be in the retail trade. So a friend of mine mentioned that City College had a film school, which was little known at the time. It was called the City College Film Institute, and it was started by Hans Richter, who was a German expressionist filmmaker.
Oh.
Made some wonderful short films about the inflation in Germany, and he was quite an artist, a painter, writer. And he had started the school, and when I applied to it, it was a tiny school. I was the only person taking courses in the day session at the time. I had to take all my courses at night because there was nobody knew about it. And I just found that I loved the editing process. I had a wonderful teacher named Roger Tilton, who made a great film called Jazz Dance. And when I looked at it after I worked with Bob Fosse, I discovered there were a lot of images in it that Fosse used. I don't know. I never had a chance to ask Bob if he had seen the movie. But,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was called Jazz Dance, if I didn't mention that. So, and also the head of the school was a guy named George Stoney the year I came in. And that was great fortune for me because he liked my work. And he asked me if I would edit my short film, which was actually a 3-minute, one camera, 16 millimeter load. Basically editing for me was taking out the flash frames, but I messed around with it a little bit. And he recommended me for a summer job carrying a camera through the hot woods around Nyack, New York, filming a director's wife doing ballet in the woods. I think everybody made that movie at some point. And the cameraman had been a student at still was a student at City College, and he offered me a weekend and night job at an editing facility. So I took that while going to school. And I just loved it. And things developed from there.
And I know one of your first jobs was this as a sound editor on East Side, West Side, which is a show I've loved. I know when we talked on email, you said you noticed I did an episode on it. How did that job come to you? How did you get that job?
Well, okay. When I got out of school, I wanted to apply to various places where I might do some editing. So I went to a couple of networks in New York at the time and a couple of other places, and they all said, well, no, you're draft eligible. You're probably going to be drafted, and no job for you. So I decided to move my draft number up and get that over with and maybe pick up my career after a little time in the Army. And as I said, I had been working for a guy, for a company that's doing sound work. And so he suggested that I contact the head of the Army Pictorial Center at the time, a major, and see if I could get there after basic training. And I did in a kind of a devious way, but I was able to get myself posted to the Army Pictorial Center, where by coincidence, I worked, I met again a music editor who had become a civil servant. And he taught me an enormous amount about music editing. And when I got out of the Army, I wanted to get back into film, was offered a job with a commercial house, absolutely hated it, and took advantage of the guy that had recommended me to stay in, to meet the head of the Pictorial Center. He had a small music business, and I worked with him for a while. And based on that and my previous working at Ross Gaffney, the music and picture house that I worked at, a composer I had met there asked me if I would come on to the first show he was doing, which was actually The Nurses, which right. was... Yeah, it's so I did a couple of small Defenders show at the end of that show's long run. And then I did a year of The Nurses. And then as a sound effects and music editor. And then it was a simpler time then. And so then I was able to transition, you know, from those things. I did a couple of series for David Susskind, one of which was East Side, West Side, which was a very exciting project because it had great a great cast. Mm. It was written by Arnold Pearl, who was a blacklisted writer. And it was very left politically, which matched my own sympathies at the time. All the editors on it were extremely, well, to varying degrees of leftist. And so we were excited, and we were very disappointed when the show was not picked up for a second year.
Right.
So, right. Yeah.
And was that enjoyable to work on?
Oh, it was terrific to work on. It was wonderful. The supervising editor was a guy named Sidney Myers, who did a film called it's been a while. Sidney was a polymath, a charming man. And he was a wonderful editor. So, yeah, it was just great to be around these people. I was fairly young in my early mid-20s, and it was just very exciting. They were shooting in the same building that I was, well, maybe that was a different series. But I did, you know, get to hang with the on the set a bit, and which I never liked doing much. And then it led to a couple of more series with David Susskind's company. And then I just I wanted to get out of it. I wanted to not be a sound editor anymore.
Right.
Kind of lucky.
Did you ever meet George C. Scott on that?
Fleetingly.
Okay.
It was a busy day on the set.
Right.
You can imagine. And there was not a lot of hanging out, besides which I had work to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course. And for people who don't know exactly what a sound editor does, can you talk a little bit about, like, does a sound editor responsible for all sound, sound effects, audio, except music? Is that generally what the sound editor is responsible for?
Yeah, you put it very well. I mean, when you when you do a film, I mean, they record sound on the set.
Yeah.
There are supplemental things that you need on a very simple level. If somebody picks up a telephone, you have to put a phone ring before it.
Right.
If somebody opens the door, you need a doorbell or a door knock. And I mean, that's simple.
Right.
Later on, they developed sound editors began to be sound designers, which I'm not knocking. But at that time when I was doing it, I found it extremely simple. And I began to get bored after a while.
What was boring about it?
Putting in a phone ring when before somebody picked it up.
Yeah. I
mean, you know, and everybody understood what I did. My family, when I did the nurse's show, I would put family names in on the intercom so that my aunts and uncles would feel somehow that I was doing something honest.
I mean, go ahead.
No, my family never quite understood what I did for a living or why I would opt for a job that ended after 9 months or a year. You know, everybody's
right.
Supposed to have a real job. And
right.
I never had one my whole life, which is great.
Right, right. And so that was actually something I was going to ask. So your family didn't, you know, understand exactly what you did. Did they give you a hard time about being in film? Would they pressure you to do something else, or
no,
what was that like?
No, it was just sort of understood. I mean, my dad, you know, opened his shop every day, and he felt everybody should open their shop every day.
Right.
And I always cherished the idea of being freelance. I mean, there's it's a little scary to freelance because when you start, you have no idea when your next job is going to come. And a lot of people double up because they feel they have to somehow take care of their families. And I never had that feeling until my daughter was born. I used to go long periods without working. I would go fishing. My wife and I would rent a cabin somewhere or a house. So I liked the downtime in between, but I loved working on projects. When we became a picture editor, it was much more exciting for me because every day there was a different kind of problem to solve.
Mm.
Every movie was a different kind of problem.
Was there any significant gaps over the years where you were concerned about your next job? I mean, judging by your resume, it looks like you were quite busy, but were there any struggles over the years?
Well, after I did Network, I was nominated for Academy Award and I was getting a lot of phone calls, but I was living in New York.
Mm.
And at that time we had two separate unions. Both divisions of the IA, but the country was split apart. So though my side of the country attempted to remedy that, we hired a lawyer who looked into civil rights issues, and I couldn't really work in California. And most of my jobs were coming from California, offers were coming, and my wife was pregnant. And we had two miscarriages before that. So I didn't work for about over a year. And
wow. This is after Network.
After Network, yeah.
Okay.
I don't think I actually did anything, which worked out because I had to take, my wife had to, in Victorian terms, take to her bed to avoid another miscarriage.
Mm.
And my daughter was premature, so I remember vividly walking home from the hospital that night and walking down Broadway and saying to myself, boy, I'm a father now. I have responsibilities and I really better get out there and see if I could find a job. And that night, there were maybe three film offers on my answering machine when I got home. And they timed out, so I was able to do both of them. All that jazz was delayed, so I could fit in a bunch of stuff in there. And then here I am.
Is that why you later moved to LA in the 90s? Was it just getting, were you getting frustrated having to say no to so much stuff because it was in LA?
No, by that time I could have worked. Of course, it involved, if somebody wanted me to work in LA, I would have to, they would have had to pay for a standby editor and a whole bunch of other, and expenses, which I did quite a bit of. But apart from being kind of destructive of family life, it became untenable. And besides, my wife and I by that time had decided to divorce. And my daughter was about to go to college. So I figured, what better time to see if I could live in California? And I did. 26, 27 years ago. Yeah.
And I just wanted to get into your relationship with Lumet, because the first film you edited was The Seagull, and then the last of the Mobile Hotshots. And then you worked on the sound department for the Palm Broker, The Group, and Bye Bye Braver Man. You mentioned he didn't work well with editors. Why was that?
Sydney came out of live television, so the editing was basically done with finger snaps.
Right.
And in fact, when we shot Network, control room scenes, we shot in Toronto. And the people behind the console were real technicians, Canadian technicians. And we would talk afterwards. They were amazed at how Sydney controlled the material in the console, what you saw on the screens, because that was live. All of that was live.
Right, right.
And so Sydney felt, he loved cameramen, he loved writers. He loved pretty much everybody, except he did not really have a good feeling for the editing process. Sydney was very fast, very fast. He made, 70 movies probably. I don't think anybody will ever come close to that. It's just not economically feasible anymore. But Sydney made a bunch of movies. And I asked Sydney one day when we were doing Network, I said, how do you pick your movies? And he, since I had done The Seagull, which I think was a better film than the critics did, because God, that was a shock to me, but that's another story. But I said, how do you pick your movies, your projects? And he said, look, he held up his hand. He said, you do five movies and one is gonna be very good and one is gonna be terrible. And the others are gonna be okay or average. And the important thing is to keep working. And I took that to heart. But after the first two movies I did with Sydney, the first one, Seagull, he stood over me and he told me exactly where to make cuts. And the only time, he would sometimes put his hand on the brake of the Moviola. These were all on film, not electronically done.
Right.
And he put his hand on the brake, which was kind of my job. But okay, that's what he wants to do. And you know, we cut the film and I was learning an enormous amount. I only drew the line when he actually tried to put his foot on my foot pedal. And I stepped on his foot kind of hard one day and he never did. It's kind of sneaky of me, but that's what I did. I was a younger man then. Anyway, I did that. And then I quickly did Last of the Mobile Hotshots, which was a misbegotten movie from the beginning. And I had to leave it because I was going to go do The 12 Chairs for Mel Brooks in Yugoslavia. And Hot Shots was running a little bit over. And Sydney really, he asked me to do another movie. I was not available. And then Network turned up years later. And I just, you know, you read the script of Network and this is a marvelous movie. But I did vow to myself, if Sidney put his hand on my handbrake, I would walk out of the room. I mean, I was not good. By this point, I was perfectly ready to cut my own movies.
Right. And did he let you do what he wanted at this, what you wanted? Like, he left you alone largely. Is that because of his relationship with Dee Dee Allen, what he had learned from her?
I believe so. Yeah, I believe that Dee Dee did Dog Day Afternoon. And Serpico.
Right.
I don't remember the order, but the
Serpico
deal
was first. Yeah. Serpico, then Dog Day. Yeah.
And I believe that Serpico was supposed to be directed by another director, and Dee Dee had a contract.
Yes.
Cut it.
Yeah.
And Sidney took over. Then before the shooting, the other director, as I understand it, wanted too much control over the script, and the studio balked, or the producers balked, and they brought in Sidney. And because of
that, was John G. Alvinson, I believe.
Yes, it was. It was.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Who later won an Academy Award for Rocky.
That's right.
Which is
yeah.
kind of ironic because Sidney was up for an Academy Award that year too.
That's right, for Network.
And I remember running into Avildsen late at night at the hotel in Los Angeles, walking around with his Emmy sort of his Oscar clutched to his chest. I felt bad for Sidney because I think Network was a much better movie. But
oh yeah, I agree.
At the moment, yeah. So did the producer years later because I worked with Bob Chartoff on a terrible movie.
Oh, is that Beer?
Beer, yeah.
Beer, right.
You're good. yeah. I said to Bob, we had trouble. As I said, I digress. You're going to have to hold me on the track. But I did. We had the actress, the original actress on Beer was just terrible. And I had said to them, she wasn't much, to the director and the producer and the writer, I said, she's not much of a actress. This is before she was hired. And they said, no, she's great. We've seen her in Nightclub. She can hold the audience in the palm of her hand. Well, you don't have a palm of your hand, so to speak, on a screen. It's very different.
Yeah.
And she was absolutely awful. So they had to replace her. And talking to Chartoff one day, I said, you really need an actress who has the energy and the drive of Faye Dunaway in Network. And Chartoff said to me, you know, I never saw Network, which I found amazing.
Wow. Wow.
And the next morning at the elevator at the hotel, I ran into Bob and he said, you know, I watched Network last night. I can't imagine how Rocky won an Academy Award. So,
that's a good story.
But when I saw Rock, oddly enough, the Richard Halsey, who edited Rocky, co-edited Rocky, we've become friends over the years. And he was just over, he and his wife were over for dinner the other night. You know, the stories, I like the backstories rather than actual technical stories very much. I like the fun stuff that happens in the background.
Oh, yeah, we all do.
We were midway in my career somewhere. No, at the beginning.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, we were talking about your relationship with Lumet. The relationship with an editor and director is interesting because obviously it's different for every director and every editor, but as you were saying, Lumet was over your shoulder on the first two movies telling you exactly what to do, and then he left you alone much more so on Network. So when you take on a project, what do you have a meeting with the director to hear about what their vision is, or do you get some kind of a feeling so you know what to go on, or how do you like to begin?
Well, it's always valuable to have a meeting, you know, read the script. That's one thing. I've rarely turned down a film because of a bad script. That's another story. The important thing is to have a meeting and see if there's some kind of relationship you feel, some kind of, it's like a first date
Right. Something.
You sort of feel each other out a little bit, and one hopes, you know, you always hope you'll get the job, whatever it might be. So I started digressing. I'll make it very quick. I did a film called The Fan, where Robert Stigwood was a producer. And the original director was a guy named Waris Hussain, who had done a couple of movies. And the movie, when I signed on to do it, was a thriller. And I got a call from the line producer who said, "We fired the director, brought in a new director because the producer, Stigwood, wants more blood in the movie." And I said, "Well, I'm not sure I want to do a film that's a slasher movie as opposed to a terror movie, as it were." And I had a contract, so I had to stick with my contract. Much as Dede Allen was contracted to do Serpico. So Sydney was kind of stuck with her. And at that point, I was a sound editor, mostly on feature films then. And when Sydney and Dede were announced as a pair, all of us in New York were saying, "Oh, this should be very interesting, because it's an immovable object and a..." It was tough, we thought. But because of the schedule, Sydney let her cut the movie. And he realized that there were things in the material that he probably hadn't thought of in advance. And the film was certainly terrific.
Oh,
yeah. And moved. And I always felt Sidney had tended to be a little wooden in his rhythms in the cutting room. And so when Network came up, I mean, he had already done Serpico. Dede was not available to do Network, I think, is part of it. And also, Fosse had probably recommended me to Patty Chayefsky, who was one of the producers, and of course the writer. So when I started the film again, it was butter. It was just wonderful.
You mentioned it was quite easy. You felt it was easy to put together.
It was incredibly easy. Sydney does not shoot a lot of takes for the most part. I was shocked that I got an Academy Award nomination for it. But when I looked at it again, or you know, as I was doing it, I knew I was working with great performances. I did very little. It came out of the camera and I started putting it together. There were some problem sequences. An actor would go up on a line and there was a scene with Faye Dunaway in the kitchen when they confront each other, and Bill Holden gives that incredible speech about an aging writer. And, he went up at one point. These were long takes.
Yeah.
But I felt there were places I wanted to see. I wanted the audience to see, and I wanted to see because I regard myself as the audience, which might be a little egotistical on my part, but I think that's my function, to make it interesting and to keep people watching and listening. So, there were places where I wanted to see Faye's face, but otherwise I would have stayed on Bill Holden pretty much the whole time, but he went up at one point,
mm-hmm.
went to her a second time. But otherwise, the stuff was easy to cut. Sydney wanted to cut two scenes, the ending. He wanted to be with me on that, and also the Mad as Hell scene. So he came into the cutting room. We did the Mad as Hell scene very quickly. That's with the audience, with the people all around New York City screaming out the windows.
Yeah, right.
I would have liked to have taken another shot at it, but I thought it was pretty damn good the way it was. And then the ending, Sydney came across the street, and this is how Sydney was. He was shooting right across the street from where I was editing in a disused recording studio. And he came over at lunchtime and he said, "This is what I like to see." Boom, 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 boom. And he laid out 10 cuts. And in my head, I knew this was not going to work. And I did exactly what he asked. He looked at it and he said, "Do it your way." And he went back to the shooting on the set. and I did it my way, which is what's in the movie now. But that was one I could not understand this concept, even when I saw the dailies. We didn't really talk it over much. I knew where it had to go. And he just had I don't remember his version. You know, the interesting thing about working on electronic media, and I never really did it either, but you could save things. And on film, it was very difficult to save. I mean, once you cut it, you can make a loop. All of it was a time-consuming and expensive process to make a dupe of something. I wish I had the opening, my original opening of All That Jazz, the dance rehearsal, dance audition, which was...
Because you said it was much longer, right, initially?
It was longer. Yeah, mine was about 12 minutes long, but it would have been a great documentary on the audition process, but it was not, it began to slow the movie down, right? At the beginning. You don't want to do that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, no, I love that. I love that opening. Just touching on that scene that you just mentioned towards the end with William Holden and Faye Dunaway. You told this story about how you had suggested to Sydney to reshoot it because Holden was out of focus.
That was a slightly different scene.
It's not the same scene. I thought, okay.
No, it's not the same scene.
Okay.
I believe that's the scene where he comes home. And he's at the bottom of the staircase. It was in her duplex, and he's looking up the staircase. And when I saw the dailies, the railing behind him, the stair rail, was sharp, and he was a little out of focus. And I called Sydney when I saw it, because they were still on the same set. And I called Sydney, and at dailies that day, he looked at it, and he said, "No, it's okay. Nobody will notice. It's going to be on for a short time." And he was right. I mean, when I look at it, yeah, he's a little soft, but so what?
Yeah, because I have it here. I watched it again the other night, and I was looking out for it. I was like, I couldn't see it. I couldn't quite spot it.
It's after the scene. It's after the kitchen scene.
And
I think he goes upstairs and starts, but she has already started packing his stuff, I believe. It's just before that scene, I think.
Okay.
It's been years. It's been a long time.
Yeah. Well, if I couldn't spot it, it must have been quite minor. But I take it. Is it accurate to say that Lumet was more about the performances? If something went out of focus a little bit, he was just like, he didn't want to do it again.
Yeah, and I never actually. Well, Sydney said, and he's right. You know, you're not going to get an actor to the same place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes you have to do it if it's really terrible.
Of course.
I did a film where the cameraman or the focus puller, actually, there was a reflection shot in the mirror, and the focus puller focused just from the mirror to the face. And when you're shooting in a mirror, you need to double that. It seems against logic, but the depth of field is what the mirror image shows. So if you're 3 feet away from the mirror, you have to focus for 6 feet. And so we had to reshoot that. That was really out.
Yeah, if it has to be done,
To go back to Sydney, I learned a very valuable lesson from the very first film I did on The Seagull, because Sydney was very protective of writers' words. And in this case, it was Chekhov. And the script had been written. The script was not important so much. It was an adaptation written by a Russian woman of that period, the Baroness Budberg, I believe. But Sydney wanted to take out about 3.5-4 minutes of a scene with Kathleen Widows, and he said, "Try this." And so I took out. Well, before doing it, I said, "Sydney, her head is going to spin around like Linda Blair in The Exorcist. It doesn't make any sense." And he said, "You know, try it." So I did it, and her head spun around. And Sydney said, "That's okay." I said, "Sydney, it's terrible. You can't do that." And he said, "Don't worry. It's projectionist error." And I said, "Sydney, what is projectionist error?" And he said, "Most people go to the movies once. This was in a different time, remember?"
Of course, yeah.
Most people go to the movies once, and they figure if they see something this bad, it's got to be that the projectionist ripped the film and made a bad cut, a bad splice.
Right.
It was very valuable to me over my career. I mean, I didn't focus on matching action or things like that. I mean, I did when I could and when it felt right, but I just tried to keep the story moving.
Right. And I actually was just last night watched that really terrific documentary you produced, Cutting Edge. And they had mentioned, I forget who the editor was in the early days of Hollywood, who said, if people kept saying to her, all these shots don't match, she's like, I don't care. It's about the emotion. So I suppose that's more important. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, I definitely would. I mean, you don't want to jar people. You don't want to take them out of the movie, but you want to hold them in. A friend of mine wrote a book called something like The Lean In Moment. And he talked about it in every category of work. He was an editor who became the head of the editing track at USC, Norman Holland. And the book was fascinating because he talked about this lean-in moment where you get the audience sort of moving for what's happening, and you change it. You deliver in some other way. You keep them moving all the time. And he talked about it with costume designers, with cameramen, with everybody. And, you know, there are no rules when you're editing.
Right.
So you also talked earlier about the relationship between an editor and a director. And I always felt that it was a very psychological relationship because the editor is interposing himself between the director's vision of the project and what the director actually put on screen. And they're not always the same thing.
Right.
So it's a political position. You are walking a line, and in order to stay or become that, to make a career as an editor, you have to be able to walk that line. It is not the editor's picture. People say that's an editor. You know, I was fortunate. I worked with Fosse, and the structures of the films were often on the outside like a turtle shell. And but with Bob, the structure was part of the storytelling. So there was a lot of freedom there.
Yes, I actually I wanted to get into the Fosse films because I love the way you played with time in those movies. But just back to Network, I know you told this story that I really find interesting is the when you transpose the cuts from the scene where William Holden and Faye Dunaway are having sex and all she's doing is talking about work, and right. Which is a very funny scene, and then it immediately cuts to Holden leaving his wife, and you don't even you just know based on her reaction. I love it starts on her face and she's crying and you know right away, oh God, he's breaking the news. You don't see that kind of editing very much. I like that nowadays, like they just kind of like the, you know, often I in films, not that there's anything wrong with it, but a scene will end on a close-up or a dissolve or a music or someone will walk out of the room to give the audience a sense that, okay, this scene is ending. But I love that just that abrupt cut, which you saw, of course, in Lenny and all that jazz a lot. So I was curious, how did you come up with that?
Well, I didn't come up with it, for God's sake. I've always wanted to just keep it moving.
Right.
And that was maybe one of my weaknesses. Sometimes I should have lingered a little bit, but I always like to get out and move to the next scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because somebody might find out that you're faking. What happened with that one? Now let me think.
Because he wanted to cut that scene,
no,
right?
No.
Lumet?
Well, the scene, Lumet, Chayefsky, and the producer, the co-producer who was Patty's partner, they said to me one day, let's take out the scene with Beatrice Straight, that she played the wife.
Yeah.
And I said, no. It's a great scene. It
really is.
I felt it was one of the best scenes of middle-aged love, as it were.
Yeah.
Married love. And the destruction, or maybe not the destruction of a marriage. You know, we don't know how that ended. Actually, it ends on a note of hope by the end of the movie.
Yes, it does. Yes.
Yeah. But they felt that the Beatrice Strait scene, which was 2.5 minutes long, was hurting the movie. It was just, we were looking to get a little time out, about 3 minutes of the movie. And we eventually found it elsewhere. But in that case, I didn't want to take that scene out. I just felt it was too good. And I said, why don't we just transpose that scene? Now I'm trying to remember. Oh, yeah. Well, the lovemaking scene came after that scene.
Right, right.
And I said, we have to have the lovemaking scene to show how shallow she is as far as the emotional relationship. And then we go to this really emotionally hot relationship in a way. It's a married relationship. It's a serious relationship.
Right.
And not that his affair with her wasn't. She nailed it. I mean, the wife, Beatrice Strait, nailed it in her performance.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, I didn't take it out. And then a couple of days later, somebody said, why don't you take out that scene? And you know, again, we're cutting on film, so it's not, if you're doing it on an electronic thing, it takes a second to remove a scene. It takes, you know, 30 seconds to transpose things.
Right.
But I kept saying, let me move this scene. And they said, no, just take it out. No, let's leave it. And I don't know exactly what I was hoping for, except that I knew that Dan Melnick, he was the actual executive producer of the film. And Dan and I knew each other from television. And I knew that when he saw this scene, that he would feel differently about it. So he came in on a Friday and we ran the movie for him, the whole movie. And then there was a discussion afterwards, and I went home eventually. And Monday morning, I got a call from Howard Gottfried, who was Patty's partner. And Howard said, Alan, and he sort of sang my name. Dan Melnick came up with this great idea. How about transposing those two scenes? And I did something I never did. I mean, I said, you know, Howard, I've been after you guys for 2 weeks to do that. And you said, no, just get rid of it. And he said, does it matter where a good idea comes from? And he's right.
Yeah. I mean, no, it doesn't.
Stayed in the movie, and she, for a 2.5 minute scene, won an Academy Award, which was amazing.
It also gave Holden's character, it just showed him as a more flawed person, the fact that he's having this affair and then with this shallow woman and then leaving this very strong woman who he's been, because his part is, you know, I think if he wasn't flawed, he would just be the good guy trying to help Peter Finch. But that gave him more, it made it less one dimensional. It gave him more,
less of a buddy movie.
Exactly.
It brought in a character. It was a three character movie, really.
That's true.
Lovely, wonderful characters with great performances, but it was their story, the three of them, and to have this, and his wife in that speech talks about affairs with your secretaries on trips and things, and she could deal with that. It was a marriage, you know. But here, this was serious. He was breaking up.
Oh, yeah.
A life.
Yeah.
More than one life, because he had a kid. And, you know, the whole thing was very serious stuff. And, you know, that's one of the few battles I win. You know, you win or you lose. I just, whenever I want to make a change of that kind of magnitude, I try and show it to the producer if they don't like it, or the director. And if they don't like it, I'll put it aside at some point, and at some point I'll bring it back. I'll just hold on to it, but I'm not going to have a knockdown fight over these things.
Right. Of course. Was that last, I love the last scene where you see Peter Finch killed and then it goes to, they're showing it on television with all these screens, and then the other screens are like little commercials of children. It's right. It was funny, you know, how was, all that was together to make it look like, oh, it's just another, it's just something else on TV. Was that in the script, or or was that, okay, it was. I was wondering if that was okay.
The commercials for various reasons.
Yeah.
We picked the commercials for budgetary reasons because we could get them.
Right.
A lot of stuff you did with Sydney was for budgetary reasons.
Right, right. Well, he was always under budget, right? He was always on time, under budget. Yeah. I mean, it's incredible.
Well, that's why he had this great career.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he did, you called it Blood Kin. It had several different titles, but that was a Tennessee Williams play called The Seven Descents of Myrtle, which was not a hit.
Oh, right. Yes. Yes. I haven't seen the play. I watched the movie, The Last of the Mobile Hot. You're talking about The Last of the Mobile Hot Shots?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was all right. I mean, but as you said, you know, he made his share of great ones and then his share of poor ones and mediocre ones.
I mean, in that case, I know that Warner Brothers called him because they had bought the script. They were stuck with the script and they knew Sydney could deliver a film.
Right.
And they could get it back into the theaters and money would come in. I mean, that's how the film business works. Whether it's a success or not almost doesn't matter. But you've come in on budget and budget. I think the problem with that film, the play, the character played by Robert Hooks, who was a very popular black actor at the time, the brother, the half-brother.
Yeah.
Was actually played in the stage play by an Italian actor, a white actor whose name escapes me. And so when you realize that he's half black, it's a shock.
Right.
But here, Sydney told it right away with that first.
Oh, I see. Right.
Really, I thought that was just blowing it.
Yeah.
It took the tension out of that story early on.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's like on paper, it sounds like, cause I love Tennessee Williams plays and films and up, you know, Lumet did The Fugitive Kind and on paper, it sounds like such a great story, but I don't know why it just didn't quite, I've never seen the play. I don't know why it just didn't as a film couldn't just didn't quite, but from what you said, that's a, that seems like a strong,
that was a major flaw and there was nothing
major flaw there. Right. That's interesting.
The script was written by Gore Vidal.
Right, right.
You know, you want to talk about meeting people backstage. Sydney rehearsed for 2 weeks. He rehearsed everything for two weeks. He did it like a play.
Yeah.
There was a table read. Then there was a read. Then they taped the room so that the couch was here and that this was there. And they put in some furniture by the end of the 2 weeks. And the actors were walking around doing, they knew where to go. And Gordy Paul was in the room every day with us. And we'd go to lunch at Ratner's downstairs. It was fun. And you would talk with the actors and talk with the directors. That was with the writers. That was fun. Yeah. I was very young. Who knew? I wasn't that young either. So there. Go ahead.
I was curious, what was he, outside of working with him, did you get to know him personally at all, Lumet?
Yeah,
or was it mainly a creative relationship?
No, a little bit. But Sydney was, my later wife was my apprentice on that movie. And we didn't start dating for many years after that. But then Sydney would always ask me about, my wife, Craig McKay, was my assistant. My wife was the apprentice. And Sydney would always conflate them. He would always say, how Craig and Allison? Like, it was sort of like one word. But Sydney developed the en passant kiss. You would run into Sydney, the elevator doors would open. And you'd get off, Sydney would get on. And in the process, he'd give you a hug and kiss you on both cheeks. And it was all very warm and very lovely. And deep inside, I'm never sure he really knew who I was between movies.
Oh, but, is that right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was in a restaurant on the Upper West Side where Sydney lived at that time, later, much later, eating with Allison, my wife at the time, my late wife. And Sidney came in with his wife and a couple of other people, and he saw me in the restaurant, and he came over and started talking to me in a very warm and affecting way. And then I realized he didn't remember who I actually was, that I had worked on three movies with him at that point.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I mean, he knew that he knew me, and he knew that we had a relationship. There's a lot of stuff you do in that business is transactional.
That's true. Yeah. This I imagine, is before you actually edited his films. You mean he didn't know you?
Even after being an editor.
Oh, no. Wow.
Definitely.
And okay, I thought maybe you meant from the sound, because maybe as a sound editor, you may not.
We had done three movies as a sound editor.
Yeah.
And I barely met him until the third one. He didn't come to mixes.
Right.
Because he was on to his next project. So, anyway. When we were doing the group, Ralph Rosenblum edited the group, and I was a sound editor, and I was in charge of the mix. So the producer of the film came in, and I don't remember his name, but he came in, he started making changes. And this is not okay in my book. So I called Ralph. Sidney was in England doing The Hill, one of his better movies.
Yeah, great film.
And I called Ralph Rosenblum, going through the chain of command, and Ralph called Sidney in England. And, you know, the next day, Sidney was back in the cutting room, in the mixing studio, just stopped the changes, because that shouldn't happen.
Right.
It's just not the function of the producer with the relationship they had with Sidney. So, and then he started coming to the mixes, and then when on Bye Bye Braverman, we actually met and talked, and he did not get along with his editor. You were talking about personal relationships. He didn't get along with Jerry Greenberg, who was a wonderful editor and an old friend from New York. And Sidney asked me then if I would do The Seagull, his next project. And I was looking to get out of sound editing, and it was, you know, get out of jail free.
Right. There's another really interesting story you told, which I didn't know, was that Chayefsky wanted to fire Faye Dunaway. Was it mainly because she was fumbling over the lines? Was that the main reason?
Yeah.
It's hard to believe because she's so good in it. I mean, the energy is fantastic.
But if you watch the movie, and you obviously did, you watch the movie, she stumbles a few times in her big speeches. In the big speech, when she's wearing the white gown and she's speaking to all of the...
Banquet hall, yeah.
She fumbles there a couple of times. But I fought very hard. Sidney came to my cutting room one morning. He would come, and I don't remember why, but we went over from my place to watch dailies with everybody else around lunchtime. And Sidney came over, and he told me Patty wanted to, like, you know, to replace her. And I just fought like crazy, and I pointed out to Sidney that the energy she was bringing was invaluable, and I think he knew it.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
I think I might have helped in the final argument. I don't know, but she brought so much energy to that role.
Yeah, no, she's fantastic. She was really, really good. Just after watching it again, I mean, everybody is fantastic. I mean, one of the ones that stood out to me even more. I've always loved Duval, but he's such a monster in this. I mean, he's such a cold, calculating person. And, you know, for years, people would say that, oh, this film predicted the future. And that's always been true. But I think it's been well over 10 years since I've seen it, you know, before the Trump era. And now I'm like, oh, my God, what is it? This is like a documentary, you know, in the last 7 years. I mean, it's just, it seems to get more and more relevant. It's scary.
Well, yeah,
it's worse than it. This is.
Patty was prescient.
Yeah.
I mean, he saw what was going to happen with Fox News, you know, with television news. It's exactly what happened.
Exactly.
It became a leading source, as opposed to just cool Walter Cronkite news. And, you know, we're still with the oil crisis.
Mm.
We use quite a bit of documentary footage, newsreel footage in the movie. That stuff is still timely.
Oh, God, yeah.
I wish he was still alive, though he would be in his 90s now, I guess.
Yes.
I
Did
wish
you meet
Elsa was
him
still
much?
alive. Oh, Patty, yeah, we spent a lot of time in the cutting room. But I had met Patty before. I met him at a party at Bob Fosse's house where I discovered he cheated at croquet. But you wouldn't hold it against him. A terrific, terrific human being. Just a
yeah, such a great writer. Marty and all the live television
and Hospital. Don't forget
Hospital. Yeah, George C. Scott. Great That's movie. Absolutely, absolutely fantastic. Well, Lenny was I have it here as well. This is a film I've always really loved. It had a real. It's so powerful. I mean, all the films you did with Fosse, the three films, are so emotionally powerful. And the story that you told about how Fosse wanted Hoffman, he felt that Hoffman lacked the edge of Lenny Bruce. And so this is how you came up with the idea of during the scenes, then cutting to the stand-up routines and breaking it up that way. Do you know why he couldn't get that out of him on the set? Why he just sort of printed and move on, or were they just butting heads way too much?
There was a lot of tension. Dustin had done a couple of movies. He hadn't done a lot of movies. And Bob had won the Triple Crown that year. He had won the Oscar for Cabaret, an Emmy for Liza with a Z, which I edited.
Right.
And what was the third award? Oh, and the Tony.
The Tony.
Yeah. Right.
Is that Chicago? Must have been Chicago.
Pippin. No, it was for Pippin.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah. Which
I think Chicago was a little later.
Yeah, which the very acerbic critic John Simon described Pippin as a triumph of a man over material. And the man was Fosse and the material was the book. And we were doing Lenny at the time. You know, there was always an interesting overlap because we were doing Lenny and he would go from my cutting room to rehearsals for Pippin. And he'd come back holding
his. Oh, my God. Yeah.
And he really, it's an incredible triumph. It really is, because it's not much of a book. It's still playing. I mean, it's still used in schools, and then revivals occur. And
Right.
But it was brilliant, and the cast was brilliant. So, okay, I digressed again. Back to my getting me back.
That's okay. Just discussing his relationship with Dustin. Do you know why he couldn't get that out of him on the set? That more edgy performance?
You know, many directors don't want to let actors see their dailies for many reasons. One of which is that actors will subtly change their performance after seeing day one, they might change it for chain two. And you might not want that as a director. And you certainly don't want it as an editor. You don't want to have two different people that you're trying to put together. So I do know this. So Fosse won the three major awards that year.
Right.
And the studio said, okay, what do you want to do next? And Fosse said, I want to do Lenny, which was a Broadway play at the time, written by Julian Barry. And the budget was minuscule, probably $2 million. And Dustin probably got $1 million of that.
Oh, wow. God.
So Fosse shot it in black and white, I think for it to be newsreely kind of.
Yeah.
I also maybe, and I don't know, but it might have been done also because it was cheaper. It's possible.
Oh,
I don't know.
Okay.
But there was a constant budget crunch. And Dustin likes to do many takes. Many
right.
takes.
Right.
Which is another story I can tell you about a different movie. But there was no time. And Bob really wanted to just keep everything moving. And the producer, who I knew for a long time, really, he was on the set, the line producer, and he was making Fosse cut script. And Fosse hated cutting script. And I was editing in a hotel in Florida, which is where we were shooting. At that time, you could have many empty nightclubs in one hotel and many empty nightclubs all over Miami. So Dustin would occasionally corner me in the hallway and say, "Can I see my dailies? Can I see my dailies?" I said, no, I'm sorry. You can't see your dailies." He would get angry and hostile, but you know, actors want to be liked.
Right.
And Lenny, Fosse and I discussed this. Lenny Bruce probably didn't give a shit whether you liked him or not. He was up there on stage to do what he did. And Dustin always seemed to be wanting the audience's love in the room. You know, it was all done in front of people. And it softened the performance. So when Bob said that to me, I thought it was going well, except when he said, you know, he's just too soft. I came up with this idea of interspersing. The script, by the way, was incredibly complex. It interspersed the past and the present. You talked about it earlier, you know, messing around with time. And
so that was already in the script.
That was in the script.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I never saw the show, so I don't know what that was like. I know.
Yeah. The play was very, I've read the play. It's very, very different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Julian Barry, who was a friend of Lenny's, when he wrote the script, he wrote a film script originally. And he went to Peter Guber, I believe, and said, "I want to do a film about Lenny Bruce," before he wrote the script. And he got the go-ahead to do it. So he wrote the script. And he came back to the studio. Within the studio said, "This is filled with dirty language. We can't do this." He said, "It's a film about Lenny Bruce." What? So the film script became the play. And then it became film again.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So Julian... we taught a class together, one class. We lectured for somebody at USC. And Julian's memory of the script, that it was very complex, was quite accurate. But my memory is that we made it much more layered, much more complex, because I discovered, and I had a sense that if I got out of Lenny real fast doing one of his routines and went to the real life incident that triggered it, it would make it edgier.
It really works too.
It does. If you don't linger,
yeah,
enough time to think. Yeah. Right. So Bob said, "Try it," and he left. And I put together the first two scenes of Dustin doing his stand-up and having a fight with Honey at some point. I think I don't remember the actual order, but I did those early scenes. That early scene, Fosse came back, showed it to him. He said, "Great, let's do it all the way through." And that's when I became an editor. That's when I realized the power of what I did. And so, yeah, that was always a struggle. Dustin absolutely hated the way the film was treated his performance. So he got an Academy Award nomination, I believe.
Yes. Yeah.
And he just hated that idea. But we did give him that 6-minute scene in the middle where we don't cut at all. The Chicago nightclub.
Oh, when he goes on high?
Really high. Yeah.
The medium. Yeah. Sorry, not medium. It's all done in a master.
Yeah. And the reason, there were two reasons, which become very technical. But what we were shooting in, as I said, real nightclubs, and there was air conditioning inside. And outside, we took the film to put it into changing bags and things like that. The film picked up static electricity between the warm, humid air outside and the cold air inside. So we got a call from the lab before I ever saw the dailies. They said, "You've got a lot of flashes of static electricity on the film." Okay.
Oh, no.
So I told everybody on the set, and that night we saw the dailies, and it was pretty appalling. I tried to treat the material the same way we had treated all the other material. That is, quick cutting and moving around. And just couldn't make it work. I mean, the flashes were so bad. Where he gave a good performance, there would be a flash. And where he was not good, there would be a flash. So I put it together with second-rate material. And we looked at it and said, no, it's not working. What are we going to do here? We need this scene. And we said, you know, he deserves to be on the stage. I mean, Fosse actually said that to me. Let's give him his 6 minutes. You know, let's not cut. We had no choice, but.
So that's why the whole thing's a master. That's interesting.
And it was brilliant because it makes him seem.
Yeah.
I always felt he was a little bit like it's almost an operating room and all the students were around and he was a subject, you know.
Really, yes.
Like a pinned bug. He was there. There was no place to go.
That's such a great scene. I really love that scene.
Yeah, me too.
It's also a shame. Not much cutting. What was that? Sorry?
Not much cutting. I mean, I always like it when I didn't have to cut a lot.
Yeah, right. Except,
you know, if I could, you know, I think there's not an editor in the world who would say, I have to cut this.
Right.
You know, if you had the performance.
Yes. Yeah.
To go through a whole thing. Yeah.
Well, it's a shame. It's a shame he didn't like how it turned out, because it's such a great film and he's so great in it. I mean, it's one of my favorite performances of his. And I thought that really worked by cutting into the comic routines, because for example, the one of the early times you did it is after the car accident with his wife, and then he says he sleeps with the nurse when his wife's in the hospital, and then you cut to him making jokes, not necessarily directly about that incident, but about guys cheating on their wives. And it makes him look worse. Yeah. You know, like, it worked really, really well.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say at this remove what was in the script and what wasn't in the script, you know, particular transitions. But basically, the structure of that film was made in the cutting room, remade in the cutting room. It was a great script. When I read the script, it was delivered to me in the evening, and after my wife was not, she was having a bad cold or flu, she had gone to sleep early. And I ran in at about 11 o'clock at night. I ran in with the script and I said, you got to read this. And she said, tomorrow. And I said, really great script. And then it got better.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And you had said that even at the end, there was a whole, after he is sentenced to prison, and there was supposed to be a whole other 20 minutes. And then you just went right from him being taken out of the courtroom to his corpse. And I love the cut, because the lawyers close the briefcase and right then it goes boom to his corpse. Was that, because as you had said, well, you know, at that moment he's dead. So what was that footage like? Was it meant to sympathize with him more, or?
Yeah, you actually see the footage. There are fragments of it. Now I'm trying to remember if it's after he dies or in the courtroom. I really don't remember. But there was a scene of him wandering around the empty swimming pool.
Yes.
There's a scene where he says goodbye to his daughter that had much more stuff in it.
Yeah.
What happened there, about 8 o'clock at night, we had to show the film to David Picker, who was the producer of it. And we had to show it the next day. We had been stalling David for a while. He had been very patient. And he was a gentle, wonderful guy. And a great producer, because he left you alone. But we really had to show it to him. And so Bob took all of us out to dinner, my crew at the time, maybe four or five people. And we all went to the Palm and we had a nice big dinner at 8 o'clock at night, nice steak dinner. And we came back 8:30, 9 o'clock to the cutting room, figuring we're going to work all night, which has never been my method.
Right.
And in the elevator, I said to Bob, why don't we just kill the son of a bitch? And Bob said, what do you mean? I said, you know, after he's dragged out of the courtroom, his life is over. That's it.
Yeah.
And we went back to the cutting room. I would say we weren't there more than 20 minutes. I took out a bunch of crap. That's what happened. It was after the courtroom, there was a whole bunch of stuff of his decline. the swimming pool empty, eating peanut butter out of a jar with spoon, getting fat.
Right.
All of that was at 20 minutes or so of nothing. It really was not, it didn't tell you anything about this guy. So I whipped all of that out. Basically, I took out two reels, just bonk, put the two pieces together, and there it was. Then we, after we showed it to David Picker, we went back and we carefully put in a couple of minutes that we felt were needed to show his decline, to show that he was a human being, you know, apart from everything.
Right. And where, you know, and that's, to me, that sounds like such a great idea. Do these, do you just kind of go with your gut on where, when you have come up with ideas or?
Yeah, usually you become script bound, but also you'll do things like, well, okay, this isn't working. Why don't we put the end of the movie at the beginning? That's an easy one.
Right.
It's a whole story of flashback. Why don't we do this? Why don't we do that? You know, it's, I go by my gut. Craig McKay, who became a truly great editor, always says that in interviews. You go by your gut. Gut is not a word I use a lot, but yeah, it's you go on your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of important.
Oh no, absolutely. Well, it worked so wonderfully that the most I think Dustin's have said about it was just telling us a couple of stories about researching. Researching Lenny, just have some interviews I've seen with him, but he hasn't said much. I believe Alec Baldwin interviewed him about it, so I'd have to find it. I'd have to find it. He just said it was hard to work with Fosse. That's all I saw from it. I'd have to find it.
He was young. He was really young, and he was full of beans.
Yeah.
And, that's an expression you won't hear a lot, but he was... you know, he really wanted to do that. Years later, I had a meeting with Robert Benton about doing Billy Bathgate.
Oh, yeah.
And I really wanted to do Billy Bathgate because I grew up in that neighborhood, sort of. And, 30 years later, 40 years later, but still, it had some resonance for me. And I had lunch, you asked earlier about meeting with a director, and Benton is a lovely man. And he said to me something that chilled me. He said that he had worked with Dustin, of course, on the divorce movie, Kramer versus Kramer.
Kramer, right.
And I don't know if he did another one. He must have done another one with Dustin, too. And he said he has a relationship with Dustin where Dustin will give him what he wants, give the director what he wants. But then Dustin will want to do the scene the way he wants to do it. And I thought that's got to be trouble in the long run.
Well, yeah, when they're editing, right?
And Benton said, you know, so that's how I get him to work with me. And that's how we do it. It's okay. That's fine.
Yeah.
One day, so, you know, I mentioned earlier that Dustin wanted to be liked, and I really believe most actors want to be liked no matter who they play. So in this film, he was playing Dutch Schultz, who was a stone killer.
Yeah, it's a good movie. I've seen it.
It's an interesting movie.
Yeah.
It has a major casting problem, which is the kid.
Right.
The kid was too self-possessed. The kid was too big. He was also physically big, a big, handsome kid. Dustin wanted a... It's kind of interesting. Dustin wanted Benton to hire a protege of his who looked a lot like Dustin, kind of skinny and long-faced. And Benton didn't think he had the chops for it, or whatever reason. That stuff happens before I'm ever involved. But so Dustin came to the dailies one day. Benton is a guy who lets actors come to dailies. And he came to dailies and he was carrying a paperback of the book. And he said, I was the only person in the room at the time. And he said, look what he left out. Look what they left out in the rewrite. And this was a scene where Dustin, as Dutch Schultz, is talking to the kid and he takes a gun out of his desk drawer, maybe on the desk, and it has a lot of phallic symbolism in it. And it's a terrible, wordy scene. And Dustin absolutely insisted that they shoot that scene. They write it, because it was 10 pages, you know, you got to get it shorter. And we shot it. And the producer, I mean, Benton, who was one of the producers, he was incredibly unhappy. They were also running way over schedule. And I ran into him on a Saturday. We worked half day Saturday. And he was fuming because Dustin was now really insisting. I think Dustin came to church right after church. Benton was a churchgoer, is a churchgoer. And he came and he just insisted the scene be done. And so they had to shut down for a day, I think, and rewrite the scene. Meanwhile, when I just sort of ignored Dustin at that point. I mean, not cruelly, but we talked about the scene. And then he realized he wasn't going to get much support from me. And then Nestor Almendros, the cameraman, walked in and Dustin held up the book and went through the whole routine with Nestor. None of us wanted to shoot it. And when I saw the dailies, Benton, to give him credit, said, well, let's see what you can make of it. And I said, you know, Benton, I think I'd like you to be in the room with me when I cut this. And he said, no, you do it. And I did. And it was terrible. It was slow. It was obvious. It was, you realize why people, Tom Stoppard wrote the script. And, you know, when I met Stoppard later, he said to me, who wrote this thing? The actors? Which was... Because Dustin had taken all of the lines from the character Hill, Arthur Hill, was that who played the accountant?
I can't remember. You know, I saw it once years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I thought I had it, but I couldn't find it.
One of the sympathetic characters in the book. In the book, his name was Abadaba. I never knew why, but it's kind of a great nickname. And they never used it in the script, and I never found out why. But he also was the guy who nurtured the young Billy Bathgate. And Dustin rewrote the script so that he had all of the nurturing lines, which just didn't play.
Oh, I see.
The Hill character was the only sympathetic character in the whole damn movie.
Right.
Because he, as an actor, had the warmth. He had enough care to show that he cared for this kid. And Dustin couldn't do that.
Enough. I see.
I'm retired. This can't get me in trouble at this point.
Yeah, Dustin, if you hear this, don't come after Alan. Yeah. Was it tense to see him again after Lenny? Was there any tension because of Lenny?
No.
No? I mean, okay.
It was
almost 15 years later or so. Yeah.
Yeah, 15, 20 years later. No, nothing. He never mentioned
Okay.
Never mentioned
Okay. That. Well, at least that didn't give you double the conflict on...
Oh, geez.
With Dustin on that one. Well, I don't want to keep you all day. I had a number of other questions, but perhaps if you're interested, we could do it another time. You've had such a big career.
Sure, if you want to. Yeah, I could have fun doing that. I enjoy, you know, I like to talk about these things, and I think there could be maybe a little bit of knowledge passed on, not much, but a little bit. And I think, I like to talk about these things. I mean,
It works for guys like me, you know, because we want to put it out there. We want to, you know, I love to hear about it. So
we ran jazz at the Academy, or the Academy did the other day at the Academy Museum in June. And I figured I would get a call to take part in a program of some kind. And I didn't.
Oh.
And, but I wanted to see the film on a big screen. And also the Geffen Theater is just wonderful. It's a big, big theater. It's new, it's beautiful. The sound is great. The image is superb. And when first place, a lot of the audience had never seen the film. And, you know, you forget that. And so many films, you know, that was almost 50 years ago. It's a long time. So there are two generations already that maybe haven't seen the film. Right. I also, the week before, by coincidence, I was asked by some people at Amblin to come up for a little private screening they have for their workers, the crew there. And there might have been 20 people in the room. And again, there was a Q&A afterwards, but many of the people had never seen the movie, never heard of the movie.
It's interesting.
So, you know, it's there were 20-year-old kids there, and you know, they're starting their careers.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in film. They might have been in marketing. There might have been another. But, you know, there are certain historical films that people should just see.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. Well, that's partly why I'm doing this podcast, just to raise more and more awareness for, you know, so many great films. Just lastly, before you go, there was something that Jonathan Kahn in that documentary, something he said, that something I think about often, was that he said that editing, Michael Kahn, sorry, who did
Spielberg's editor. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Spielberg's editor. He said something I think about often. He said that, you know, editing is manipulative. You know, that's what filmmaking is. Would you agree that that's what film editing is to manipulate the audience?
Yeah, surely it is, because you want to keep the audience involved in the story you're telling. So yeah, you go to a close-up because you say, I want them to see the look on this person's face. You choose different shots, you choose different performances because you want the audience to care, either like or dislike or something, for a particular character. So every cut you make is manipulative in that sense. When right. I first started on television, I was doing a couple of shows, a sound editor for the Defenders, really, or maybe the Nurses. And there was a very efficient editing system that was going on. There were three editors. It's not something you do anymore, but we never worked overtime. Everything was done. But I would sit with the assistant sometimes, and we would discuss, and the editors at lunch, and we would discuss whether it's harder to do a documentary or a theatrical film, a story film. And I always felt it was really hard to do a documentary, because you had to tell a story with the material. I've done some.
Right.
And I enjoyed them immensely, but mostly political films. But with a dramatic film, it's sort of the same. You are still trying to pull out the very best and keep the audience intrigued. So yeah, it's manipulative. Sure it is. It's more manipulative than a documentary, I think, right from the beginning. But every shot you do. Yeah, George Stoney, who was the head of the Film Institute the year I started there, he took us down to the pier in 125th Street in Harlem, in Manhattan, at the Hudson River, with the camera, the only camera we had for the school, which was a Cine Special 2, a good workmanlike camera, but that was it for the school. We had nothing, one Moviola, one camera. Anyway, he took us down there, and we looked around on the dock to see what we could film that would be interesting, and that wouldn't be a still necessarily. And he pointed out there was a fence on the dock somewhere, and there was a white guy and a black guy, both probably homeless people, or just people taking the sun. It's been many years, I don't remember. But he framed the shot. He showed us how to frame a shot. And between the fence and the two people, you told a story, almost like in a still picture. But as an editor, I don't have the ability to frame shots. But one right. hopes to work with a director. I was getting this somewhere. But one hopes to work with a director who does, who knows how to put an angle on a shot that makes you question, that makes you curious, that makes you interested. I mean, Fosse always had his camera where he wanted it. And it was always a little bit unusual, a little lower, a little higher, a little to the right.
Yeah.
The opening of Lenny with Valerie Perrine.
Right.
I mean, when I looked at it at first, I thought this is really odd framing. This half her face.
You mean the strip scene? Is that the one you're talking about?
No, the interview scene. The interview.
When they're cutting to interview her, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's right on her mouth initially.
Right on her mouth.
Yeah.
Then there are shots where she's only, half.
Yeah.
Fosse was always pushing the boundaries.
Yeah. I love
even
all that.
There, when I started on the film, I said, are we going to replace your voice? Because he was asking the question. He said, no, I like it. I like the fact that you can't really hear what I'm saying. You can half hear what he's saying.
I noticed that. So yeah, sometimes I'd be like, what did he say? What did he ask?
Well, it's better to lean in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Back and walk away. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The reason I asked that is because, Hitchcock, for example, he would say, if he's showing his movie and a Japanese audience is watching it and an American audience watching it, if he wants it to be a laugh here or a scream or for people to get frightened here, he wants both audiences to be reacting at the same moments. Whereas other filmmakers, one of my favorite filmmakers is Nick Cassavetes, who I know you worked with, his father, John Cassavetes. His films, he really sort of wanted the audience to be involved. So he wouldn't tell you certain things about why the characters are doing what you're doing, or a scene might go on for, a long time because he wants to put you through it. So you get all kinds of different reactions from an audience. So the word manipulative, I suppose that's, when is it sort of really on the nose, feel this, feel that, and when is it a little pulled back for the audience to, I suppose editing is you can manipulate them in different levels, I suppose. I mean, would you, if that makes sense?
The idea is to keep eyes on the screen, eyes and minds on the screen, and ears too. I mean, the whole process. And when you're editing a movie, you're also involved in the sound effects. Yes, you have sound designers, but you talk about that before they start. Music, all of those elements, and then you put it together, the picture, the performances, and then you put it together on a mixing stage and you make things louder, softer, you subtly do things. It's not cut and dried. When you're young, you think, gee, that's a movie and that's thrown up there. Somebody shoots it and it comes out just that way on the screen. Never. Basically never, I think. As controlling, that's not the word I want to use, but Fosse controlled a lot on his shows. And the fact is that it never was exactly what he wanted, but it was close enough,
Right.
And that's why we worked together so well, because I could deliver to him what he wanted in some way. I could read what he wanted and try and put it together that way. It was a nice relationship. I wish he had made more movies.
Oh, me too. I mean, me too. I mean, it's a shame he died so young, because I mean, I have all that jazz here as well. I mean, they're just, and Star 80, of course, and Cabaret. I mean, they're so powerful. I'll let you go, Alan, because I don't want to keep, we could talk all day, but perhaps
yes,
you could.
Good. What time is it? Oh yeah, I should start getting.
Yeah, you should. I'll let you go. But I'd love to have you back sometime, and we could talk more about the second half of your career.
Okay. Yeah. Send me an email, and we'll get together again. This has been fun. Thank you very much. It's really been nice.
Thank you so much, everyone, for watching and or listening. If you are currently listening to this on the audio version of my YouTube channel and you've run out of episodes to listen to, head over to the YouTube channel where every single episode that I have ever recorded can be found, youtube.com/Robert Bellissimo at the movies. I also want to thank all of my members on Patreon. If you're interested in becoming a member of my Patreon, head over to patreon.com/Robert Bellissimo at the movies for full details. You can also leave a donation directly to my YouTube channel if you wish. Just below the video box here, you will see the links that will that says like, dislike, comment. There's another link right beside those links that say thanks. Click the thanks link, and from there, you can leave a donation if you choose to. And lastly, if this is your first time here, please consider subscribing to my channel. By pressing the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo, you will see it floating above my head in the top left corner to your top left in just a second. Just click on that. And then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release one of my new episodes or when I go live. Thank you so much, everyone. I will see you in the next episode.